want to do a very thorough job in understanding all the challenges that are associated with operating in the Arctic.
Norwegian officials with Statoil talk development to Nome residents. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, August 28th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, Buccaneers jackup rig arrives in Kachemak Bay.
I think that with the interest that some of the other players have shown in the Cook Inlet, that rig could be busy for many years.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by ConocoPhillips. The easy oil is gone, and getting to the remaining oil will be a challenge that will require the state and the industry to work together. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. And by Providence Imaging Center, helping cancer patients stay in Anchorage with a PET scanner that fuses anatomical and functional images since 2004. Learn more at provimaging.com.
Statoil is inching closer to exploratory drilling in Alaska's Chukchi Sea, although the company says not before 2015. A delegation from the Norwegian oil company held a public meeting in Nome last night. Operating on 16 leases acquired in a 2008 sale and partnering with ConocoPhillips on another 50 leases, the company's potential drill sites sit about 150 miles northwest of Barrow. While company representatives reiterated that Statoil's plans to drill in the Chukchi might never come to fruition, a presentation by Lars Sunda, Statoil's exploration manager in Alaska, displayed optimism about Alaska's role in the company's future.
Alaska is an important emerging area for Statoil. With our competence from the Norwegian waters and the Norwegian Arctic, we feel that our technology and knowledge level is a very good fit for Alaska.
Statoil conducted fieldwork in the Chukchi Sea beginning in 2010, completing seismic testing of the seafloor. Their 2011 work included sonar to look for shallow gas pockets that could present risks. They also took soil core samples to get a sense of the stability for a jackup rig. In his presentation, Sunda detailed plans for one exploration well and one to two appraisal wells at depths between 115 to 145 feet. A mobile offshore drilling rig or potentially a jackup rig would be used, along with a contingent of support ships and oil spill response vessels. The company says they can only plan to drill during the open water season in ice-free conditions. Even with these plans, Sunda says schedules are far from firm.
What we're doing is to plan an execution of a drilling program. We don't know when that might take place. It will not be earlier than 2015, maybe later. But we want to do a very thorough job in understanding all the challenges that are associated with operating in the Arctic and make sure that we do this properly.
If they drill and if they find oil, Statoil favors building a pipeline to deliver the oil to market. While such decisions are years, likely decades away, the company says they would partner with other oil companies on such a project. At the meeting, residents of Nome asked questions about the impact Statoil ships would have on subsistence species. Statoil marine biologist Jürgen Weisenberger says the company's ongoing outreach to Bering Strait communities and regional corporations is shaping their plans and schedules. The company is continuing to refine its plans to have zero impact on marine and subsistence species. When asked about a recent claim by Greenpeace that a surprising number of soft corals have been observed on the Chukchi seafloor, Weisenberger says the coral are well documented and likely won't be affected by drilling. Statoil opened its Anchorage office in 2009 and has held more than 120 meetings on their Chukchi plans this year. The company's visit to Nome, their second this year, was sponsored by the Nome Chamber of Commerce. The Doyon Native Corporation has ambitious interior Alaska oil and gas exploration plans, seismic work in the Yukon Flats and drilling in the Nenana Basin, both this winter. Emily Schwing has more from Fairbanks member station KUAC.
The corporation will convert 400,000 acres in the Nenana Basin, currently under state license, to seven-year state leases. They'll also begin the permitting process to drill a new deep well in the basin. And they'll conduct a new round of seismic testing on Doyon and Village Corporation lands in the Yukon Flats. The Interior Regional Native Corporation's president and CEO Aaron Schutt says the work would not be possible without incentives and a change in the state's oil production tax regime.
This type of partnership with the state will allow us to examine the results of that well and possibly drill another well.
Doyon will seek permits for 3 wells, but the corporation currently only plans to drill 1. Fairbanks Representative Steve Thompson says this was the kind of result he was hoping for when he introduced the bill.
You needed to make sure you had the drilling tax credits. You had to have the production tax for a company to be able to regain and recover the cost of bringing a successful well to production.
Drilling and seismic work are scheduled to begin in late January and continue through early April. In Fairbanks, I'm Emily Schwing.
Anchorage and South Central residents today were promised they will have enough natural gas on hand to make it through the winter. A dispute had developed between Marathon Oil and the underground Cook Inlet Natural Gas Storage Facility, which had been elevated to a complaint before the Regulatory Commission of Alaska. Officials with the storage facility had said that Marathon was directing its gas production to overseas markets instead of meeting its commitment to fill local needs. In a statement released today, Marathon said it is not violating its agreement and has already begun transferring gas to the facility. Anchorage Democrat Pete Peterson was among several legislators who had asked Governor Parnell to get involved in talks between the two companies.
The storage facility is going to be able to hold somewhere around 11 billion cubic feet of natural gas, but they knew that they were not going to be able to reach that number this year, but they're going to be able to get 7 billion in there this year. But with the shipments diverted to Japan, we were worried whether we were going to be able to reach enough gas where there'd be enough pressure where we could draw it out as fast as we needed it on extreme cold days.
Peterson said he's anticipating positive reports at the end of the season that will indicate the amount of gas that might become available in future years from other Cook Inlet explorers. Residents of Homer have had a few days to get used to an unusual sight on Kachemak Bay, the presence of an enormous 400-foot-tall jack-up drilling rig. As KBBI's Aaron Selbig reports, the rig belongs to Buccaneer Energy, which plans to put it to use in Cook Inlet in the coming weeks.
Buccaneer Energy's jack-up rig, named the Endeavor, is a Marathon Letourneau 116C. That's one of the largest such rigs in the world. The Endeavor arrived in Kachemak Bay Friday after a long voyage from Singapore, where it was being prepared for use in Cook Inlet. Jim Watt is president and chief operating officer of Buccaneer Energy. He says the plan is for the Endeavor to tie up at the Homer Harbor for about a week while it's being worked on. Once the rig is ready for drilling, it'll be headed up to the northwest part of Cook Inlet, just north of ConocoPhillips' Tionic platform, to drill its first well. He says the Endeavor will then do some drilling in the Cosmopolitan Unit. That's an area in the southern inlet near Anchor Point, where Buccaneer recently purchased the rights to drill. Watt says the plans for winterizing the Endeavor have yet to be finalized, but parking the rig at Homer's deepwater dock is still an option. Some Homer residents, however, think Kachemak Bay is no place for an oil rig. The bay, after all, is a designated critical habitat area. The Alaska Department of Fish and Game, however, has ruled that the rig's presence does not violate that designation. Cook Inlet Keeper Board member Michael O'Meara acknowledges that decision.
That said, it doesn't reduce the potential risk that's involved in bringing something like this into the bay.
O'Meara calls on Buccaneer to make its spill response plans public, and he wonders what the company will do if there's a well blowout in Cook Inlet. He points to a recent report by the Alaska Oil and Gas Commission, saying that some of the equipment Buccaneer would need to cap a blown-out well is not yet in the state.
As the Oil and Gas Commission stated to them, if I might paraphrase, the time to plan for a blowout is before it happens, not after it happens.
O'Meara is also concerned that the only other jack-up rig in Cook Inlet, the Fury-owned Spartan 151, is too small to assist the Endeavor with relieving a blown-out well. Watt points out that the Endeavor was originally built to work in the North Sea. He says it has recently been re-outfitted and will meet or exceed any standards for safety and emissions. Watts says Buccaneer is a member of Cook Inlet Spill Prevention and Response Incorporated, or CISPRI, a Coast Guard certified oil spill removal organization. He asserts that the company's spill response plan is, quote, comprehensive. Asked about a worst case scenario, like the Deepwater Horizon spill in the Gulf of Mexico 2 years ago, Watt points to the record of jackup oil rigs around the world.
The Horizon event that you mentioned, that was in deep water where the blowout preventer was on the seabed floor. Using a jackup rig, all of that equipment in terms of the blowout preventer is in dry conditions. In essence, it's up at the above the sea level, and so it's fully accessible. And for this reason, you know, thousands of wells have been drilled all around the world without incident in terms of the conditions that we're looking at to drill here in the Cook Inlet.
Watt says the Endeavor will stick with the normal Cook Inlet summer drilling season between April and late October. He expects the rig to work in the inlet for at least 2 or 3 years, hopefully longer.
In terms of the longer-term plan, we see that rig busy for several years. And that's just Buccaneer's activity. We'll, you know, obviously the rig's available to other operators. And I think that with the interest that some of the other players have shown in the Cook Inlet, that rig could be busy for many years.
Watt says that Buccaneer Energy and the state of Alaska are well positioned for a boom in activity, as well as a resulting boost in jobs and supplies of natural gas for South Central Alaska. O'Meara says Cook Inlet Keeper will continue to monitor Buccaneer's activities in Cook Inlet. In Homer, I'm Aaron Selbig.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, resource competition between fishermen and sea otters.
Our people used to say when the table, when the tide is out, our table is set. Now when the tide is out, we got nothing but a shell bed down the bottom.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline for 35 years.
Alaska Housing Finance Corporation offers home choice seminars that provide tools for making informed decisions about purchasing and financing a home, and loans tailored for first-time home buyers. There's more information at ahfc.us. This message sponsored by Alaska Housing Finance Corporation.
The Bering Strait is known as the gateway to the Arctic. Increased global interest in the resources of the region is beginning to attract investment, but access and infrastructure remain the big challenges. Yesterday at the Arctic Imperative Summit in Girdwood, a panel of Alaska Native leaders discussed their community's readiness to handle increased commercial activity in the Bering Straits region. George Nungwak chairs the Alaska Eskimo Whaling Commission. He's from Savoonga on St. Lawrence Island and knows well the risks of living in the harsh Arctic environment.
There are physical risks to our livelihood from poorly timed or located development activities that could alter migratory route and make it harder or even impossible for us to reach our subsistence resources.
Nungwak said poorly planned development could interfere with hunting, and increased shipping could bring pollution and invasive species. Nungwak did not take an anti-development stance, but he did stress patience. To succeed in the Arctic, you have to approach nature on its own terms, he said.
So when you live in the Arctic, you learn to wait for the opportunities that nature gives you. We know how to wait for our food to arrive as migrations occur.
Nungwak urged companies planning Arctic development to proceed slowly and cautiously. June Walunga, acting general manager of the native village of Gamble, has a long history with the Norton Sound Health Corporation. Walunga told the group that shipping lanes are not clearly defined and that that in itself is a threat to St. Lawrence Island.
Looking at that map with all the traffic that was going there, that's quite a bit of heavy activities going there. And that's exactly where the migration of the walrus and the bowhead whale are.
Wolunga said St. Lawrence is the closest point of contact for any shipping emergency and that her village is not prepared to rescue large vessels. The discussion was part of the Arctic Imperative Summit, a three-day symposium that wrapped up yesterday. The state of Alaska is working with the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers to locate a site for a deepwater port. Alaska Senator Mark Begich says he plans to introduce legislation creating an Arctic Port Authority to facilitate Alaska's future international shipping needs. Begich made the announcement over the weekend at the Arctic Imperative Summit. KSKA's Ellen Lockyer has more.
Senator Mark Begich is a strong supporter of greater ice-breaking capacity in Alaska's Arctic waters. Begich's remarks during his talk at the Arctic Imperative Summit pointed to the cooperation of Nome Area Sitnasauk Native Corporation and Vitus Marine in bringing life-giving fuel to Nome last winter.
People back in Washington would say, well, what's the latest? What's happened? What's going on? It was kind of like the Iditarod of the 21st century on ice. It was kind of an interesting change of events that brought people's attention to what's going on, but also brought to the attention of the administration and others the fact that we have limited ice-breaking capacity.
That attention-getting moment highlighted the needs of the Arctic for a while. Begich says it's important to keep national focus on the Arctic.
Do we need a deep water port? Yes. Do we need additional ports? Yes. Better communication systems, weather satellites, helicopter hangars, pipeline activity to move what's in the Chukchi and Beaufort to our overall pipeline that moves it down to Valdez.
He stressed that the Arctic is becoming a new destination for tourism, too. But lack of infrastructure is the challenge, and Begich says he's going to do something about that.
We are an Arctic nation. We need to have the resources to approach this new opportunity for us in the right way with the right infrastructure. When I get back, we've been working on a piece of legislation. We'll introduce it in September, and it will create the Arctic Port Authority, which will design an area and create an opportunity for us to create an independent, semi-private U.S. Arctic Deepwater Port Authority to plan, finance, and build and maintain such a port. And it will be critical for our oil and gas industry, and it will also be critical for our logistics and support for the full utilization of what goes on in the Arctic.
In addition, he said the legislation would authorize the Port Authority to establish subports to serve as regional transshipment hubs to facilitate commerce in Arctic communities. Begich said the aim is to establish a network of ports to serve future shipping needs. The senator pointed out that Shell Oil Company's plans for the coming years include 22 support vessels. Begich said that in 3 years, 200 vessels could be serving Arctic oil development alone. Alaska Lieutenant Governor Meet Treadwell told the group that the state is working with the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers on locating a site for a deep water port.
If Shell is successful in its exploration, you're going to see a need for developing small ports on the North Slope for servicing that. So the very interesting question, and I think the prospect of a port authority is a provocative question to look at, is how should we try to finance these ports together or separately? The question with any port is what throughput is going to pay the bill.
According to Treadwell, transarctic shipping depends on cooperation among the international governments involved to help decision makers look at coordinated investment in ports and airports. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Northern Air Cargo. Since 1956, Alaskans have entrusted Northern Air Cargo to transport their freight. Thank you, Alaska, for the opportunity to serve you for decades to come. Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, NA. And by Bristol Bay Native Corporation, generations of jobs, heritage, and history. Bristol Bay, a place that's always been. Online at bbnc.net.
The head of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service was in Sitka over the weekend to hear concerns about sea otters. The marine mammals are protected by federal law, but Alaska Natives are allowed to hunt them. Some of them say the regulations on what they can do with sea otter pelts are confusing and have led to scrapes with the law. Meanwhile, commercial fishermen who dive for shellfish in southeast Alaska say expanding otter populations are wiping out their fisheries. KCAW's Ed Ronco has the story.
Around the table on Saturday sat dive fishermen, native otter hunters, and local artists who use otter pelts. And in the middle of the group was Dan Ash, the director of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. He heard stories like this one.
7 years, thinking I was going to go to prison. As you guys told me, I broke the law because I put a zipper in my coat. And I put two snaps in my hat. And for 7 years, I was scared to death.
That's Boyd Diedrichson, and he's talking about something that happened in the 1980s. Federal agents seized a parka and a hat that he had made out of sea otter pelts. Diedrichson added a metal zipper to the parka and metal snaps to the hat, and because of that, the government said it did not qualify as traditional and as a result could not be sold. A federal judge in Anchorage ended up ruling in Diedrichson's favor by saying the government misinterpreted its own rules.
You busted me 3 times on 3 things, and I won every case. It's just that it's significantly altered. I know what that means.
But Diedrichson and the others said not everyone does. He said a lot of ambiguity remains, especially when it comes to different federal agents having a different take on what counts as significantly altered in an otter pelt.
It comes up all the time because it's not clearly defined.
Mike Miller is on the Sitka Tribe of Alaska's Tribal Council. He's also on its Marine Mammal Commission.
And that causes a lot of angst because one person's interpretation from another's is going to be different.
In addition to ambiguity, some also felt that the government's enforcement methods were too heavy-handed. Wade Martin, who hunts sea otters and is also on the tribal council, said the enforcement methods are like a witch hunt and that they discourage him from hunting otter. During a break in the meeting, Ash told reporters that he understood the frustration. Changes, he said, will come, but they will come over time.
Yeah, I think there is some common ground here, and I think the key is to try to make a step forward and not try to bite off too much. And
one idea is to have a workshop on new regulations where stakeholders get together and make sure that they're clear on the meanings. Ash said it would be a good way to reach clarity on some of the government's definitions.
Significantly altered, as you heard, coastal dwelling people, mass production. There are some key terms that I think that we can bring some clarity to, and hopefully that's a step forward and a platform from which then we can build trust and strengthen our relationships and then go forward from there.
The other main area of concern at Saturday's meeting was about population. Sea otters were vanquished from southeast Alaska by fur traders in the 18th and 19th centuries. In the late 1960s, they were reintroduced. The population took off about 20 years later, and it continues to grow. Dive fishermen go for the same things otters eat. Urchins, sea cucumbers, gooey ducks, just for example. But lately, says dive fisherman Larry Traney, the otters are winning.
On the gooey ducks, it's just totally amazing to think of this gooey duck bed that can go from here to the fuel tanks over here. And you swim on that area, and you have wall-to-wall craters. It looks like a bombing range. Mm-hmm. It's just absolutely amazing that they're that active.
That otters are feasting on local shellfish is also a concern for subsistence gatherers. Again, Wade Martin from the Sitka Tribe of Alaska's Tribal Council.
Our people used to say when the tide is out, our table is set. Now when the tide is out, we have nothing but a shell bed down the bottom. We need to protect our resources.
Afterward, Miller from the Sitka tribe said he thought the time was well spent on Saturday and that he appreciated that Ash took time to visit and that the congressional delegation is paying attention to the issues. But he stopped short of calling it a success. That, he says, will depend on what changes, if any, come as a result. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Ed Ronco.
Did you know the United States Army and Stikeen Tlingits fought a battle in Wrangell nearly 150 years ago? If you didn't, you're not alone. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld reports on an effort to find out more about the clash.
Tis Peterman has lived in Wrangell all of her life, but until a few years ago, she'd never heard of the 1869 Battle of Wrangell.
I happened to come across it when I did some research for the museum that was built here.
Peterman works for the Wrangell Cooperative Association, the Southeast Community's tribal government.
And it was just this buried little story, and I hadn't heard from anybody else on it. And when I looked further, it was just an interesting piece of Wrangell's history that I'd never heard about before.
That could change. The Cooperative Association and the Sea Alaska Heritage Institute are combining efforts to research the conflict and somehow commemorate the event. A $32,000 grant from the National Park Service's American Battlefield Protection Program is funding the effort.
The objective of the project is not only to understand the battle, but to understand where it occurred.
Zachary Jones is archivist and collection manager for the Heritage Institute, the cultural arm of Southeast's Regional Native Corporation. He says the research could allow for improvements to the site.
Development could include naming it a national battlefield, development of the area for tourism, or just telling the story, or perhaps even a memorial.
Jones says most of what's known comes from a military report to Congress. That document says the conflict began at a gathering on Christmas night, 1869. One version says a Stickeen Tlingit man bit a finger off a white woman who was part of the Army presence at Fort Wrangell.
The conflict originated over a domestic dispute, which then escalated into a military mobilization.
That led to the death of two Stickeen men and a white man. The military also bombarded the village.
It was largely a two-day conflict, which involved cannon fire from the U.S. Army and small arms fire exchanges between the Tlingit and the Army.
The grant award was announced earlier this month. Peterman of the Wrangell Cooperative Association hopes it expands knowledge of the conflict.
I think this research from this particular grant will find out if there's anybody that has passed down this story at all.
She also hopes the information gathered will better balance the written record. I'm Ed Schoenfeld reporting.
Finally tonight, we have a correction. In a story last night about Shell Oil's plan to request an extension for Arctic Sea exploration this fall, Shell is requesting more time in the Chukchi Sea, not the Beaufort Sea, as originally reported. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Matthew Smith in Nome, Emily Schwing in Fairbanks, Aaron Selbig in Homer, Ellen Lockyer in Anchorage, Ed Ronco in Sitka, and Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau. APRN's Dave Donaldson reported from Juneau. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. If you haven't already, remember to vote, Alaskans. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station. Check the status of your permanent fund dividend application at pfd.alaska.gov. August 31st is the deadline for contributing to a college savings plan and to add or change charitable donations. This message sponsored by the State of Alaska. How do you get men to wear a life jacket when the fact is that 90% of those who die in boating accidents in Alaska are men? Well, most men won't listen to this message, but they might listen to you. So have them pledge to wear a life jacket every time they get in a boat. Every time. Have them fill out a Pledge to Live card at pledgetolive.org. That's pledgetolive.org. Make them promise so they make it back home. This message sponsored by the Alaska Office of Boating Safety. The Kinnick Arm Bridge will create 1,500 jobs during the 4 years of construction and spur thousands more after completion by creating access to affordable land for commercial, industrial, and residential use. For facts on the Kinnick Arm Bridge, visit kinnickarmbridge.com. This message sponsored by the Kinnick Arm Bridge and Toll Authority.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.